Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjourn.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the court are posted in the clerk's office. There are three causes which will be submitted on oral arguments this morning. In the order in which they are presented, they are as follows. Rex M. Houston Trustee versus Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation from Scott Morton County. Charles Evans and others versus Thomas R. Pollock and others from Travis County. And Stephen Nolan and others versus Eric M. Ramsey and others on original petition. We will complete these three arguments before we break for lunch, but we will take a brief recess after each argument has been completed. Counsel in the second and third causes do not have to remain in the courtroom while previous causes are being argued, but we ask that you remain nearby. Occasionally, our arguments finish ahead of schedule. We also advise all counsel that these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you should desire to hear a tape of these arguments, you may make application to do so with the clerk of our court. In the first cause, the court has allotted 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument and 10 minutes for the petitioner to present rebuttal. The court is now ready to hear oral arguments from the petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Jeff Joyce and Mr. Charles McGuire will present arguments for the petitioner. Mr. Joyce will open.
May it please the court. My name is Jeff Joyce. Together with co-counsel Mr. Charles McGuire, we represent Mr. Rex Houston, court-appointed trustee for the shareholders of the former Bank of Woodson. With the court's permission, we'd like to divide our arguments into two broad topical areas. The first and initial area, which arises in this case, involves the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals to have first considered this case brought by the FDIC as receiver for the failed bank. The issue essentially boils down to whether or not the court's order from which FDIC receiver appeals was properly appealed and timely appealed. It is our contention that the FDIC appeals from a discrete issue which was previously decided by the court and not timely appealed. The second, and I will address that first issue on appealability. The second issue involves really the merits of this case. That is, whether or not interest may be properly paid on the claims of the creditors of a failed state bank in the state of Texas. The FDIC receiver essentially presented this first issue as a question of law to the Court of Appeals and acknowledges in its papers that this is a case of first impression, whether or not legally interest should and could be paid. The second subpart of that issue, though, which Mr. McGuire will address, is one of equity based upon the factual circumstances of this case. The receiver has essentially not questioned the trial court's holding. The Court of Appeals did not deal with it, but the issue is essentially whether or not a trial court in the exercise of discretion on the facts of a given case may deny interest to a creditor if the law so provides.
Is this a problem with a number of failed banks and credit associations around the state?
The issue is going to rise time and time again. As the court is aware, the economy in the state of Texas has affected our financial institutions. There is now pending a number of state bank receiverships. Both of these issues are going to crop up time and time again. The appealability question is of particular importance. These cases are now ongoing. The courts and the litigants need to know when a particular issue must be appealed or whether it can wait until final resolution of the receivership. Many of those cases are ongoing today. The second issue is somewhat unique because of the factual situation it reaches this court in. As framed in this case, it's essentially an argument between the creditors on the one hand and the shareholders of the bank on the other hand. That's a unique situation because not always is there a surplus after payment of all creditors' claims in full on the principal sum. So it becomes a question of creditor versus shareholders. In this case, the issue, however, will arise time and again in the state of Texas as creditors versus creditors becomes the area of litigation, particularly given our Texas depositor preference statute, which is now in our liquidation scheme. So yes, Your Honor, it is something that's going to arise time and again. The trial court made fact findings in this case which have not been attacked in any manner by the FDIC receiver on appeal. Court of Appeals essentially adopted those but reached a different conclusion on the law. The failed Bank of Woodson, the Bank of Woodson, Texas failed in 1982 and at that time had assets of approximately $3 million. As normally happens in state bank receiverships, the FDIC was appointed the receiver. The FDIC paid off the claims of the bank's depositors to the extent in this case of about $2,800,000 and then became subrogated to the claims of those depositors as creditors of the bank and was thus the 98% creditor of this failed bank. The substantial asset which this case is focused upon and which resulted in the surplus that this case involves was a banker's blanket bond that the bank had procured, insuring it against losses which it might suffer by reason of dishonest or improper actions of former officers and employees of the bank. The FDIC's receiver filed a bond claim for $670,000. That was not a booked asset, and the situation presented itself that if there was full recovery on the bond claim, the receivership becomes solvent again, all creditors could be paid in full, and the surplus could be paid to the equity class, the shareholders, because the equity of the bank would be restored. The receiver pursued receivership in normal course. Numerous orders were entered by the trial court, including compromises of claims, sale of assets, interim distributions to creditors as the funds made themselves available. The surplus, those activities, plus the recovery on the bond claim in 1986 permitted all creditors to be paid in full on their principal claims. The surplus, as I've mentioned, arose because of the banker's blanket bond claim in this case. The trial court found, and the Court of Appeals did not disagree with the finding, that the FDIC grossly mishandled the bond claim in this case. There were repeated efforts by the FDIC in its corporate capacity and the receiver, and in its receiver capacity, to settle this bond claim for far less than its face amount. There were not one, not two, but three attempts by the receiver to settle this claim for only a fraction of the face amount of the claim. One of those efforts was denied by the original court. The second effort was made after the original judge died, and the FDIC presented the exact same settlement to the court for approval. An additional $25,000 was added to the settlement pot, and that effort was rejected. All of those on the efforts of Rex Houston, our client, opposing that settlement for what was believed to be a grossly inadequate amount. The FDIC's mishandling of the bond claim is the subject of the court's findings of fact. Essentially, the facts here are undisputed. The employees whose activities form the basis of the bond claim pled guilty to federal criminal charges or to state criminal charges for improper bank actions. It is those actions which form the basis of the banker's blanket bond claim. So there should be no question about the bond company's liability on the bonds. Nevertheless, the FDIC chose to settle. The FDIC corporate pooled this particular bond claim with three other bond claims, which it was handling in three different receiverships in Texas and Arkansas, and reached a compromise with the single bond company on all four bond claims at once for a single pool settlement amount. And then arbitrarily, in its discretion, without agreement from the bond company or this court, allocated the settlement sum which it chose to allocate to this receivership, the sum of $236,000. It was that sum which the court rejected twice. The FDIC, according to the findings and the evidence presented, did no research on the legal defenses the bond company was asserting. And the defenses which arose substantially arose from the actions of the FDIC in handling and pursuing this bond claim. Finally, the FDIC negotiated this settlement check for this pooled bond sum, and the bonding company at some point in time was claiming that that represented a release of it from the claims under this bond. On three occasions, the trial court denied the proposed settlement that the receiver wanted. Based upon those actions, Mr. Houston moved to have a special prosecutor appointed. A special prosecutor was appointed, and the bond claim was settled at that point in time for almost face amount of the bond claim asserted. The way it was settled, FDIC, in its corporate capacity, who had already negotiated the settlement check, bought the bond claim from the receivership estate for near face amount. It was that payment, then, that permitted all principal claims of creditors to be paid in full. and the district court was then faced with the issue as to whether or not to pay interest on the claims of creditors. On January 15, 1987, the trial court entered an order on the receiver's request to make an interest payment dividend and denied the receiver the right to make that dividend. No appeal was timely pursued from that order. 6 months later, the court concluded this receivership proceeding as is authorized by the Texas State Bank receivership statutes, discharged the receiver, and that had the effect of forfeiting the charter of the Bank of Woodson and winding up its affairs finally. The remaining assets in the receivership estate were delivered to our client, Mr. Houston, as trustee for the shareholders of the bank. The FDIC receiver then appealed from that final order concluding the receivership on 2 points. Number one, it challenged whether or not interest should be paid to the creditors and claimed that the interest should have been paid and the court erred in ordering distribution to the shareholders. Secondly, the FDIC receiver was denied certain expenses which it claimed against the receivership estate, and it asked that those expenses be awarded to it on the appeal. It is our position in this case, as stated in the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals essentially did not address this issue, that the appeal, insofar as it relates to the question of the payment of interest, was untimely. The order that was entered in this case dealing with interest was not the final order concluding the receivership from which the receiver appealed in mid-1987. Instead, it was an order entered 6 months earlier on the receiver's application to pay an interest dividend. No timely appeal was perfected from that order. What is happening here is the receiver is attempting to bootstrap his appeal from the final order concluding the receivership, which wraps up all the affairs of the bank, back to an order which was final and had been finally resolved some 5 months before, declaring no interest be paid.
Is there any case or authority that requires that an appeal be taken from such an interlocutory order in the receivership case?
We've cited three cases for the court dealing with state bank receiverships, which conclude that an interim order such as that, dealing with a discrete issue, is a final and appealable order on that issue. It's very easy in this issue to get into semantics. The phrase interlocutory order, final order, interim order all come into play. But essentially what this court is faced with is whether or not the no interest order dealt with and became a final order on a discrete issue in this case.
Isn't there a difference between what can be appealed from and what must be appealed from?
Well, if I understand the court's question, if an order can be appealed from, it must be appealed if anyone wants to attack it at any time, or there is no further review once the appellate time is run, and that's our position.
You can appeal from a temporary injunction.
Because
you can await the rendition of a permanent injunction in the case and appeal from that.
I think that's true, but a temporary injunction is unquestionably an interlocutory order, which is made appealable as an interlocutory order by statute. The issue here that the court is faced with is whether or not interim orders during the course of a state bank receivership are interlocutory and therefore must be authorized for appeal by statute, or whether in certain circumstances they can be final orders resolving discrete issues in the receivership and therefore must be appealed at that time, or failing to do that cannot be attacked subsequently. That is the issue. The three cases which we've cited to the court deal with in the 1920s and 1930s time frame deal with three different transactions, but basically two different types of transactions. One involves a sale of assets, where there was an order authorizing the sale and an order approving the sale. And the case says that that order is one which must be reviewed and can be reviewed as any other order and must be attacked within the confines and within the time frames permitted by law. Two other cases deal with the payment of expenses to attorneys and payment expenses to a receiver for a failed state bank. And those cases conclude that those orders or appealable orders. An appeal must be pursued from those if someone wants to attack those. The policy behind the appealability of the no interest order in this case is apparent, readily apparent. If all orders entered in the state bank receivership, in this case over the period of 5 years, from 1982 to 1987, If all interim orders can be attacked when the receivership is finally concluded, there would be essentially no practical and effective way to wind up the affairs of a state bank. There must be some finality in interim orders, which have a discrete topic, which dispose of discrete issues, both as to law and fact. They must have some finality so that the statute can be given effect, and that when the final order is entered, those matters which have been resolved have been concluded to be final, and the receivership is finally wound up and the receiver discharged. The alternative
it
is
most important that if an order is appealable, the parties be able to tell it without having to take the appeal to find out. What bright line test do you propose to determine whether an interlocutory order in a receivership is appealable or not?
If it disposes of a discrete issue involving facts and law points which are going to govern the rest of that case and which the parties are going to be bound by. The easiest way to tell in this case, and there is a similar problem in the law, and that deals with cases in probate. And there are discrete issues which are resolved during the course of an ongoing probate are appealable. The easiest way for me to tell in this case is, assume the trial court had ruled to the contrary. Rather than ordering that no interest be paid as a dividend, had the trial court ordered that interest could be paid as the receiver wanted, would that have then been a final order which Mr. Houston, as an aggrieved party, should have appealed from at that time? The answer has to be yes. If Mr. Houston waited until the final order in this case to appeal, look what the situation would be. The receiver would have had approval to pay the dividend. The dividend would have been paid, in this case, to not a whole lot in terms of numbers of creditors, but to a number of different creditors. The receivership's then concluded, and Mr. Houston might be before this court ordering for relief that may be very difficult for the receiver to respond in.
Wouldn't that be the case anyway if the interlocutory appeal proceeded while the receivership was being terminated in trial court? The appeal of the interlocutory order did not suspend proceedings in the trial court.
The answer is the trial court could, and in this case made a finding, that no appeals were pending from prior orders, and the trial court could wait on the final order in the case, discharging the receivership, until all those interim matters had been finally disposed of.
Could, but wouldn't have to.
I don't think would have to, but I think that would be the prudent thing for a trial court to do. The policy is that there must be some finality in these interim matters as they go. If everything's up for appeal after the final order of the receivership, we're going to have an unworkable state bank receivership proceedings. The issue is going to come up time and time again as the state bank receiverships now ongoing proceed. And if the court concludes that everything's appealable from the final order, within 5 or 6 years, there are going to be a number of matters up for appeal which have occurred over the course of 5 or 6 years at this time.
Mr. McGuire. May it please the court, Mr. McGuire will now present further argument for the petition.
May it please the court, my name is Charles McGuire, and as Mr. Joyce articulated, as opposed to the jurisdictional issue raised by the petitioner's application for writ, I'm going to try and address the merits of the case, namely, should interest be paid to creditors of failed state banks from a surplus to the detriment of shareholders. As Mr. Joyce pointed out in response to the Chief Justice's inquiry, while this case may seem relatively unique on its facts that we have a surplus, I assure the court that it does occasionally rise in small town bank failures. It almost never rises when the bank is of a substantial size. However, in 1985, the legislature engrafted upon our comprehensive liquidation statute Section 342-804A, the so-called depositor preference statute in this state, which prioritized for the first time various creditors of a failed bank. And there are set forth 7 levels of payment in terms of priority, the second level being right after the administrative expenses dealing with depositors, which substantially will be the FDIC as the subrogated creditor, and to the extent there are uninsured deposits, those types of depositors. 804A specifies and this will come up time and again as the failed receivership litigation winds its way through the state court system. That statute specifies that the depositors are to be paid before number three class gets paid, which are unpaid wage claimants from the bank and so on down through general creditors until finally we come to the equity shareholders. It is not inconceivable at all factually, because most banks have considerable other creditors other than depositors, such as landlords, data processing services, and so on. It is not inconceivable at all that a receivership will generate sufficient cash proceeds to pay through the principal of the depositor level claim, but won't have enough proceeds to actually amount to a surplus to pay through all priorities. And therefore, it can be reasonably anticipated that the FDIC, as a subrogated depositor, will be arguing that it is entitled to interest after it gets its 100% principal, to the detriment of all other priority claimants, namely unpaid employees, general creditors of all types, and so on. So this case, we think, does have broad-reaching significance on the merits. We would point out to the court that the legislature, in enacting back in 1943, and they've amended it several times since, structured a very comprehensive procedure whereby a state bank should be liquidated. There are 16 subchapters, and never in the statute, including the 85 and 87 revisions, has the legislature ever mentioned the word interest. The statutes are silent on interest. Now, in resolving the merit question, the FDIC and the petitioner seem to agree on two points. One, that Texas law is going to control the outcome of a failed Texas state bank. And second of all, this exact issue is a case of first impression in this state.
If the bank were a national bank, what would be the case?
If the bank were a national bank, there are precedents coming outside the state of Texas that would suggest that interest is payable to creditors. I would point out to the court, there are state cases outside the state that suggest to the contrary in those states. At any rate, Texas has not seen fit to have this issue decided previously, and I would suggest to the court that the resolution involves several mental steps that we would encourage the court to go through. First of all, any creditor in a receivership has the burden of proof to establish its claim. That means principal and its entitlement to interest. Second of all, the legislation in the area is silent on the question of interest. Thirdly, the cases cited by both parties should be looked at. The petitioner, Houston, has cited closely analogous cases in Texas where you have different priorities of creditors, and the courts have there held on the three cases cited that a higher priority creditor should not be entitled to interest to the detriment of a lower priority creditor when the lower priority creditor has not wronged the higher priority creditor. On the other hand, the cases cited by the FDIC are all deficient because either they go back to the 1920s and the super added shareholder liability era where shareholders were responsible for the debts of a failed bank, or they involve secured creditors, or they are not Texas precedents. Finally, we suggest to the court that it is impractical in this case to award interest because of the silence of the statutes. There's no specification of interest rate, no mention of compounding, no mention of when interest accrues, etc., so there are no guidelines. Now, when I say that, I'm not unmindful of the court's rulings over the last several years, starting with the Kavner case, but those cases, to me, as enunciated by Justice Mosley, are designed to promote settlement and discourage delay. And in receiverships, creditors and shareholders have no ability among themselves to advance either of those issues. They can neither encourage the wrap-up of the receivership quicker, nor can they settle among themselves. So I also note in those cases, they seem to involve parties where one has wronged another. And in the typical receivership, we have basically innocent parties claiming in a common fund.
Mr. Houston, the brief notes, has been under indictment. for actions arising out of the bank?
Not true, Your Honor. The FDIC has said that in that brief. That is incorrect. They have said many things in their briefs incorrect. That's one of them. So we submit that the answer to the merit question is, in this state, that under the comprehensive statutes enacted by the legislature, that no interest should be paid to general creditors beyond the date of failure. That is the only scenario that makes sense to me in terms of squaring the statutory purpose behind liquidation. That is especially true when you think about the 1985 enactment 804A, where you have different priorities of creditors. Now, we also raised very briefly the equitable subordination issue. The brief filed by the petitioner recites the conduct of the FDIC in the bond claim. Mr. Joyce has briefly touched on it. For those reasons, and because there would be no surplus but for the actions of our client, Mr. Houston, the trial court, sitting as a receivership court, which is an equity court, saw fit on the facts and circumstances in this case to subordinate the claim, if you assume an interest is payable, subordinate the claim of the FDIC in its corporate capacity to the shareholders. This does not reach the 0.6% of the creditors that aren't the FDIC. We do not contend that they are tainted by the FDIC's actions, but we do contend, as the district court found, that the FDIC's actions, both in its receivership capacity and in its corporate capacity, and if the court review the records, they will see both parties sign the pool settlement agreement and so on. We submit that that justifies equitably subordinating the FDIC's claim for interest. So in short, we seek to have the court reverse the Court of Civil Appeals and reinstate fully the trial court's decision denying interest to creditors, and also holding that the appeal time has long since run in terms of the jurisdictional issue argued for by Mr. Joyce. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument for respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. T. Ray Guile will present argument for respondent.
Please the court. For the record, my name is Ray Guy, and I'm from the firm of Jenkins and Gilchrist in Dallas. I'm here along with my associate, Truman Spring, who is not arguing today, representing the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which, as you have determined, is here as the receiver of the Bank of Woodson, Texas. This is a case that can be approached in one of two ways. One way to approach it is to try to determine what the law probably is, as based on precedents from other jurisdictions and predictions from other facets of Texas law, in order to see what the law says with respect to the application of this rare animal, a surplus after all creditors' claims of principal have been paid in full. The other approach is to point fingers, to talk about the conduct of the receiver, to use pejoratives, to make this into an us versus them, local boy versus big bad regulators type of case, and that's what Mr. Houston has done in his brief. We think we can show, and we think we have shown in our brief, in our reply to the application, that there was, in fact, a proper decision made by the court below, that the emotional appeal worked in the trial court. It did not work with the Court of Appeals. It should not work before this court. There is a rule of law in this case. That rule of law, by unanimous review of the other jurisdictions, says that you pay interest on creditors' claims if there is a surplus before the shareholders receive anything on their risk capital investment. Mr. McGuire says there are cases from other jurisdictions that state a contrary rule in state law. They have cited none in the brief, and I'm aware of none. To my knowledge, the rule is unanimous in other jurisdictions and in the commentators. I will briefly talk about the jurisdictional issue that Mr. Joyce addressed and then move on to the merits of the case. The rule in Texas has long been, as this court has noted, that interlocutory orders are typically not appealable. Northeast Independent School District versus Aldridge, the court said, we have steadfastly adhered through the years to the rule, with certain exceptions, that an appeal may be prosecuted only from a final judgment, and that to be final, the judgment must dispose of all issues and parties in the case. And the next step is the H.B. Zachary versus Thibodeau case, also decided by this court, in which this court said that an interlocutory order becomes final and appealable when there is another order that disposes of all the issues and parties in the case. As Justice Hecht has noted, there are some limited exceptions. Article 51.014 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code sets those forth. They involve, for example, injunctions or the denial of an injunction. The case that's presented to the court today does not fall within one of those exceptions. There is no bank receivership exception to the rule that only final judgments may be appealed. And the three cases mentioned by the petitioner in the application for writ of error, as we've shown beginning at page 33 of the reply, do not involve a situation such as we have here. The Marietta State Bank case, for example, involved an order entered 9 months after the conclusion of the receivership. The Gossett versus Griffin case involved a claim made in the receivership under the terms of a statute that said you present your claim, the Commissioner of Banking has X number of time to pass on that, and if the Commissioner of Banking declines your claim, refuses your claim, then you have X number of additional days to file suit. The claimant files suit. When the district court overruled its attempt to recover its claim, the claimant then appealed. That's not the case here. The bright line test that I would suggest be applied is the one that the statutes provide, Article 51.014. Those exceptions clearly apply. For example, Mr. Houston sought an injunction early on in this case to stop the bank from being closed, to require that it be reopened. Had the injunction been entered, I think there would have been a permissible appeal. When his case was dismissed by the Eastman Court of Appeals, by the district court, he did appeal to the Eastman Court of Appeals. That's clearly proper. That's a separate, discrete issue there. I believe also that if you have a claim presented and the statute says you file suit if your claim is denied, that's the type of order that you can appeal from because you begin by filing suit in the district court. But as Justice Tech, I think, has made clear, there is an extreme difficulty in determining if you begin to allow interlocutory appeals, which orders are appealable and which ones are not. And there is nothing unique about this order that would make it appealable. There is simply
in
no way.
In this case, you attempted to challenge the interlocutory order by mandamus.
That's correct. Former counsel sought writ of mandamus.
Why wouldn't it be good to appeal an interlocutory order in these circumstances so that if its effect on the receivership could be established before it was terminated, then the parties would have the opportunity to do it?
And certainly if this court pours me out, I will wish the former counsel had done so. But I think the short answer, there are a couple of responses to that. First of all, the rule against interlocutory appeals is designed to prevent the repeated trips to the appellate court that are involved with the multiplicity of interim appeals. As Mr. Joyce himself said, there were numerous orders entered in this case by the receivership court approving and denying claims and such. If you allowed an appeal from each one of those, the Eastman Court could have become essentially a court to review the Woodson Bank receivership and wouldn't have had much else to do. Secondly, there is just no reason to be allowing interlocutory appeals with respect to most of the decisions that are made by the receiver or made by the court in approving or denying actions taken by the receiver. This is not unlike any other type of case in which, for example, someone moves for summary judgment, rightly believes that the case should have been decided on summary judgment, but summary judgment's denied. Clearly, if it's granted, it disposes of the case, it avoids all kinds of difficulty in the trial court, the trial becomes unnecessary, but this state has still made the policy decision that we wait until the conclusion of the case to appeal from the denial of summary judgment, take it up another way. I just don't see anything different about this case, and I would hate to have to sit and craft a rule that says what types of interim orders, if you don't like the term interlocutory, ought to be appealable in the receivership and which ones are not.
I take it the Court of Appeals denied leave to file?
It did. That's correct, Your Honor. No specification of reasons for that. I understand that the former counsel was told why by the clerk, but that's not in the record.
But the Court of Appeals did not indicate that it had considered whether the application for mandamus should be treated as an appeal?
No. To my knowledge, there was no opinion. There was a one-page order denying the application. I would also note that in response to Mr. Joyce's hypothetical with respect to what would happen if the court decided to order payout of interest to the creditors and Mr. Houston then found himself having to fight the case after the payment had already been made and trying to bring the funds back in, there is always the potential for superseding. If there is, in fact, the right to keep the payment from happening, what you do is you supersede the judgment and cover it that way. Seems to me that there is also the opportunity, if there is a particular discrete order that is dispository of numerous issues and ought to be appealed immediately, if there ought to be the possibility for the parties or one party to move the receivership court to sever that particular claim. The policy in this state is against the general idea of severing out claims to prosecute appeals while the case is still pending, but that can be overcome in particular circumstances. And if a particular order is so important, the parties can move for and the court can consider whether this is an appropriate case for severance. There is no need to allow piecemeal appeals. The FDIC did all it could in this case to try to perfect an appeal, did not do an actual direct appeal because the case was still proceeding below, but was denied the right to proceed on mandamus. And I believe the case is properly before this court and should not be dismissed. With respect to the other issue in the case, the merits of the case, I would mention one particular fact that seems to me to be of critical importance here. In this case, when the bank failed in March of 1982, the FDIC was, of course, appointed receiver. The state banking commissioner has that option. It need not choose to appoint the FDIC receiver. It can appoint Fred Jones from Woodson, Texas, if he wants to. The FDIC is required to accept the appointment if it's tendered. At the same time, the FDIC came in a different capacity, its corporate capacity or simply the insurance fund, and paid off, as Mr. Joyce said, the depositors' claims. The FDIC thus became subrogated to those depositors' claims not by some equitable doctrine of subrogation, but by statute, by federal statute 12 U.S.C. section 1821F, as we've mentioned in the reply, and also by state statute, 1821G, that is, and also by state statute, which is Article 489B, Section 4 of the Texas Civil Statutes. This is not a case in which the FDIC is in here as a volunteer seeking equitable subrogation. The FDIC is in here as a statutory subrogee entitled to present the claims of the depositors. And this court can consider this case and should consider this case as if the creditor that was out there is not the FDIC's insurance fund, which happily has avoided the loss to the members of the community, but the creditor may as well be Henry and Mabel with their $500 deposit in the bank, as if this were the Bank of Leroy or Chilton Private Bank or one of the other uninsured Texas banks that's failed recently. The principles involved in this case don't differ if Fred Jones is the receiver. They also don't differ if, in fact, there was no deposit insurance and the depositors themselves are the ones who are awaiting payment. I would also say, in response to something Mr. McGuire said, that in fact there will likely be other creditors of the bank, the light company, the phone company, and such as this. They will typically be minimal. The way a bank operates is to operate with depositors' money. By far, the largest single class of creditors in the bank is going to be the depositors. So realistically, the people who are going to have the largest single class of claims, the overwhelming class of claims, 98% here, will be the depositors. That also happens because it's not uncommon for the bank in its last death throes to pay off the local people who've extended credit to the bank. And there's no reason to pay the depositors because there is, in fact, deposit insurance. So I think the fact of a surplus is a pretty rare fact. I don't recall another one happening in Texas besides this one. It's even rarer, it seems to me, with the new depositor preference statute that there's going to be much dispute over funds going to the general creditors other than depositors. The legislature did choose in 1985 to recognize the claims of depositors or the subrogated FDIC and the excess depositors. In fact, that's going to be the claim that's going to be involved here. I would also say that I would rather Mr. McGuire not make the FDIC's arguments for it in cases that are to arise sometime in the future. There is no way for this court to determine that the FDIC would take the opinion of the Eastland Court of Appeals or an affirmance should it come from this court and use that to argue that the depositors are entitled to interest before the other general creditors get any money on their claims under the new 1985 forward depositor preference statute. That case will await another day. As Mr. McGuire has said, there are in fact cases that say that among the same class of creditors where there are tiers, where one may be entitled to preference, one is secured and one is not, there are cases that indicate you don't give interest to one before you pay principal to the other. The FDIC has never said that they're going to try to pay interest on the depositors' claims before the other general creditors get the claims, get their claims paid as far as principal, and I don't think that's a proper basis on which to decide this case.
Counsel, you say that we should look at the FDIC as a receiver as if it were an individual. You think we would take that same position if there had been an individual in this case and they had negotiated a deal to wrap up three other banks' bond claim, settling for 10 cents on the dollar?
Practically, Your Honor, the fact of the pool negotiations as opposed to pool settlement results because the FDIC does have numerous bond claims for the same bonding company arising from banks throughout the country, so it probably wouldn't have arisen. But yes, I think the result would be the same. And we've not addressed those factual things in the brief because I think the law is clear, and you can take all the diatribe you want to about the FDIC as receiver in this case and point all the fingers you want to, and you just can't shoehorn all of that polemic into a legal doctrine that says the rule is anything other than the creditors get their interest claim first. But if I might briefly address the nature of that bond claim, it is not as said by the petitioner, in this case. What happens is the FDIC does get a bonding company that will say, we've got four claims. Can we come in and talk? And the bonding company will come in and negotiate with each of the lawyers who's handling one of the claims and make its own determination, sometimes to offer money individually based on bond claims, sometimes to make a lump sum offer. When that lump sum offer comes in, the FDIC has to determine then whether it can make a fair settlement on each of the separate bond claims involved in the lump sum, whether there's enough money there for...
If you had individual receivers in each of the individual cases, you would not have had, you had just the opposite situation.
You wouldn't have had the opportunity. That's correct, Your Honor. In this case...
So to say... that the situation is the same as if there were some individual receiver appointed is just off the mark, really.
You're correct. Practically, it would not have happened. I would agree with you, Your Honor. That's correct. I would say, though, that I'm certain that members of this court, a number of you, have handled insurance litigation, and in particular, fidelity bond litigation, from probably both sides of the bench. I suspect that you've realized that it's commonplace in insurance litigation, and in particular in bankers' blanket bond litigation, for the parties to dispute not liability, not damage, but coverage. Stipulate to the bad facts in this case. There was clearly defalcation by Mr. Ballard in this case. By the way, the FDIC did not say Mr. Ballard was indicted. The FDIC said he was named as one of the parties on the loans of Mr. Ballard. Mr. Ballard was indicted. Mr. Houston was named as having received one of the loans that was fraudulent in this case, and I did not intend to imply that Mr. Houston was himself a bad actor. I think he's got closer ties to the bank than he tries to take in this case, but that's the only implication there. In this particular case, there was a conservator appointed for Bank of Woodson before it failed. The typical bond, including the bond in this case, provides that the bond terminates according to its terms if the regulators appoint a conservator. It's an extremely harsh rule, and the fact that the banking commissioner appointed the conservator was probably something of a regulatory foul-up. Normally, they will let the bank know something's going to happen. The directors can hire someone to do an investigation and perfect bond claims some period of time before the conservator is appointed. That didn't happen here. When the conservator came in, he took a look at the bond claim possibility and did cause the bank to purchase what's called discovery from the bonding company, an extended period of time during which the claim could be investigated and a claim could be filed for acts that occurred prior to the purchase of discovery. But the fact remained that if the bonding company looked real close at this case, it was going to see that there was no coverage because there was a conservator. And the FDIC has tried unsuccessfully in several cases to challenge that particular provision of the bond and hasn't done so. The courts say the bonding company is entitled to determine its risk. And part of that risk is the bonding company will be off the risk if the regulators put a conservator in.
And what regulating body did that?
The regulator in this case was the State Banking Commission. The FDIC had no authority to either close the bank or appoint a conservator. The FDIC could have revoked deposit insurance in a long, drawn-out process if things had gotten bad enough before the bank closed. But nevertheless, the FDIC did go ahead and file the bond claim, file the proofs of loss, negotiate with the bonding company, and determine in connection with this offer that was made to settle the four cases that the bonding company wasn't really seeing what was happening in the Bank of Woodson. And if it came down to having to file suit, the bonding company was going to be one of these and figure out that there was a problem here and that there might be no coverage. And the FDIC believed that if this case came down to litigation, there would be no recovery on the bond claim for the Bank of Woodson. The allocation of $232,000 for the bond claim was a generous allegation based on the fact that there was a golden case on liability and a lousy case on coverage. What happened with Mr. Houston was,
it reminds me of something that one of my heroes, Daryl Royal, said about 25 years ago. The problem with a cockroach is not so much what it carries away and eats, it's what it steps into and messes up. And Mr. Houston was present in this case, requiring litigation, threatening to lose everything for everybody. And the FDIC said, wait a minute, we're the 99%, 98% creditor. We can purchase this bond claim. We'll do so. We'll put the number into the receivership that Mr. Houston says he wants in there. And did, and proceeded to settle for what was a fair amount in the anticipation that the FDIC would then get some recovery back out of the surplus that might exist in the case. Mr. Houston's correct. He is responsible for the fact there's a surplus in the case. There probably should not be one. There would not be one if he hadn't managed to coerce the FDIC to do something that it really didn't have to do, and there could be a zero recovery on the bank blanket bond if, in fact, the special prosecutor, Mr. Pete Baker, who's a very good lawyer, had had to litigate these facts. There would not have been a recovery, and that's the genesis of the bond claim and this pooled negotiation resulting in the settlement of this case.
What did the bond attempt to pay?
It paid the FDIC. The settlement was, in fact, a global number of $2 million or $2.2 million.
On several banks?
On four banks in Texas and Arkansas. The FDIC did determine that the proper allocation was $232,000 to Bank of Woodson. The FDIC is going to lose money from having purchased the bond claim, but the receivership is going to get something out of the bond as a result. I think it's clear that the cases that we've mentioned from other jurisdictions are the best predictor of what you should do in the situation. There is a fairly, there is a unanimous rule of law that says that the shareholders have an equity investment. They take the risk of the bank going up or down. The depositors of the bank either accept a fixed rate of return or a no return at all if it's a demand deposit type checking account. In return for the certainty, they're going to get the money back. The people who ought to bear the risk of bank failure, even through to the stage of having to wait for the shareholders to get some compensation, the depositors rather, and other creditors, to get some compensation for the time value of their money retained, are the shareholders. They should not recover until the depositors and other creditors have been paid something for the fact that their money's been tied up in what is necessarily a long receivership, extended in this case by, for example, Mr. Houston's injunction proceedings, his insistence upon deposing the people who handled the blanket bond and such as this. We mentioned the general rule that you don't normally recover interest. That's when there's a fund that's not going to cover claims. We've also mentioned the numerous cases that say that where there is a surplus, you do pay interest on the creditor's claims, and we've found no cases that in fact say that the shareholders, the risk investors, get money before there is compensation for money retained during the course of the receivership. I would agree with the distinction on the old superadded liability cases. I think it's one that favors the FDIC as receiver in this case. In those cases, the shareholders were assessed an additional amount to pay into the receivership by virtue of having had stock with a par value. You could be required to pay in a sum equal to the par value of your shares. In that situation, it's an extremely sympathetic argument to say, wait a minute, we're the ones who've paid this money in, and the creditors have been paid in full. We ought to get back our money before they get interest. And the courts have uniformly held in that circumstance that even though the source of the money was the shareholders, the creditors still get interest on their claims. Again, no cases in Texas, but through the years in every jurisdiction, every commentator we've seen, the rule has been uniform, giving preference to the creditors' claims to recover interest. I believe this is a good example of why the rule is the rule and ought to be a uniform rule, regardless of what kind of scatological phrasing can be put into the brief to be filed with this court. This court doesn't need to get tied up with who was right, who was wrong, this sort of thing. And the fact of the matter is that there is a rule that says the creditors get the money, get interest on their claims. It's not going to cover interest. If you apply a 6% rule under Article 5069-1.03, it's not going to cover anywhere near the full amount of interest that would be recovered. And in fact, interest up to the 1983 dividend is not going to be covered. Nevertheless, it is some compensation, and there's no reason for Mr. Houston to get the money. He is, in fact, a bottom fisherman. He bought this stock after the bank failed or acquired it from someone, apparently in the expectation of perhaps recovering a windfall. Nothing wrong with that. But he's also not entitled to undue solicitude when the rule of law says the creditors recover first. Briefly addressing our application for writ of error, if there are no other questions from the court on Mr. Houston's, I think it's clear that the court cut off the FDIC's expenses at a time before the receivership ended because the court didn't agree with the FDIC's continued prosecution of its claim that the creditors should recover interest first. The Court of Appeals below reversed that decision, granted the relief sought on the merits by the receiver. Given that, I do believe that the court's order cutting off the receiver's expenses was inappropriate, and this court should remand back to the district court for a determination of what is a fair amount of expense in light of the fact that the appeal below was a successful one, if in fact this court affirms on the merits. If there are no questions, that concludes my argument.
Any questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Guy's argument relating to the merits of the bond claim in this case really underscores what the case is all about. The FDIC at this point argues this was a crummy bond claim that never would have paid. Nevertheless, FDIC corporate ponied up to pay face amount of the bond claim, to buy it out of the receivership with the expectation that it was going to get it back as interest on the other end. Their efforts along the way, pooling this bond claim, unwarranted efforts repeatedly to try to get a bond claim approved that the court said, no, I'm not going to approve. They're trying to cover up. They're trying to hide it. They're trying to draw it back out as interest on the back end. And not only that, they waited too late when the court said no interest. So now they're trying to bootstrap their argument back in at the end and say, now we have a timely appeal because all issues in a state bank receivership are up for grabs until the last order is entered in the case. Their position on the bond claim sums up the entire case here. That's what this is about. This is a case of first impression. The law point, admittedly, could probably go either way. This court, though, in deciding the law point on interest, must make it square with our depositor preference statute and the legislature's scheme of distribution to creditors of a failed state bank. Simply, the statute makes no provision for interest. If the court is to read in an interest requirement, it's going to do violence to the statute. It's going to have to figure out a way to add a whole new subcategory of payments to be made in the scheme of distribution. As the statute now reads, there are seven categories of claimants whose claims are to be paid in that order. The last category, number seven, is shareholders. The FDIC receiver would have this court read, as I understand their position, that depositors now are not going to be paid interest before the employees and the general creditors. The way the FDIC receiver would have the statute read, you pay down through claim six, which is the general unsecured late file claims. And then you create new categories of claims, 7 through 12, which is interest according apparently to the same scheme of distribution, which starts over as interest to depositors, interest to employees, interest to general unsecured creditors, interest to late filing claimants. And after those new distribution schemes have been added to the statute, which isn't there now, then we finally get to the shareholders. That's what they're asking the court to do in terms of the law in this case. It simply isn't there. There's a statute that deals with it, and it does not provide for payment of interest. The equitable argument, which we have made repeatedly, which the trial court agreed with the shareholders on, is that the FDIC should not be permitted to profit by its actions in this case to cover up its improper conduct in trying to settle this bond claim by a claim for interest. That is exactly, though, what the receiver's counsel just told the court the FDIC wanted to do. It said, we've had enough of this litigation. Mr. Houston is tenacious. We'll just buy the bond claim because we're going to get it back as interest. The court denied that result as a court of equity based upon the facts which have not been challenged in the Court of Appeals, which the Court of Appeals in essence agreed with as the grounds for denial of payment of expenses to the receiver in this case. The Court of Appeals found that the trial court properly concluded that the receiver mishandled this bond claim. That is the basis also for the trial court's denial of interest. And it is just as much a reason to deny interest as the law point would be.
Of course, if the FDIC is entitled to interest, generally, it would not buy a bond claim in expectation of interest.
If it's entitled to interest generally, then it would not buy a bond claim in expectation of interest? I guess it depends on how the court views it. What I think was presented to the trial court and what the findings conclude was that here was a bond claim for $600,000+ that the receiver chose as part of a pool settlement to settle for some $200,000.
Where does this 10 cents on the dollar?
I'm not sure where 10 cents came in, and I'm not sure that we've said that. I think it's more like 25 cents on the dollar. Okay. If interest is properly accrual is appropriate on the bond claim. And the bond claim expressly provides that the bond company will pay interest on the claim. Once you compute in interest accruing on the principal bond claim, it gets back to 25 cents on the dollar. What the trial court did here was, as a court of equity, denied to this receiver the right to cover up its wrongs in this case. That's essentially what happened here.
You surely don't argue that if the FDIC had demanded and received the full amount of the bond claim from the bonding company, it would also be entitled to interest.
Well, that's the law court, and I do argue that that would not be appropriate. At that point in time, the court has to deal with what is the law in the state of Texas, a case of first impression, and how does that square with our statutory distribution scheme?
You're arguing that whether the FDIC has a black hat or a white hat, it's not entitled to interest.
As a matter of law, that's correct. There's a second prong, and that is, even if the law did so provide, in this case, it's not warranted. The trial court said it wasn't. Nobody attacked those findings in the Court of Appeals, and that's where the receiver finds itself today. Any further questions?
Thank you,
Ken. Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will take a brief recess.